Hello and welcome to Big Ideas Summer of Science. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Today we consider a trip to Mars. We've landed on the moon, so now the dream is for humans to travel to Mars and establish a base there. But at what financial and personal cost? And what are we likely to discover? This Australian Science Festival event was recorded last May. Your hosts are the ABC's Bernie Hobbs and Paul Willis.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mars. Is it worth the trip? At King O'Malley's Pub in Canberra. Tonight we're taking you on an adventure. We're going to go and meet the neighbours. That is the next planet in the solar system, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to first of all figure out whether or not it's worth going. Maybe we should just send robots, maybe we should send people. Maybe we can nominate who we send on a one-way ticket. And then the logistics, how do we actually get there? Is it viable to think about actually going to Mars? We have got the best panel in the world to discuss this. Please put your hands together. First of all, the Vice President of the Mars Society Australia is Dr. Jonathan Clark.
And in the middle, wearing a jacket that looks somewhat like a cross between a Boy Scout and a bandito, the Chairman of the Mars Institute, Planetary Scientist with the SETI Institute and the Director of the Horton Mars Project at NASA Ames Research Centre, please welcome Dr. Pascal Lee.
And a friend of mine from way back, the director of the Australian Centre of Astrobiology at the University of New South Wales, please welcome Professor Malcolm Walters. Let's start with you, Jonathan, Vice President of the Mars Society. What exactly does the Mars Society do?
We do a range of things. First of all, we do things like this, public education and outreach. Communicating to people the vision of exploring Mars, what's been done in the past, what's happening now, what can be done in the future, and to educate people that Mars can be a part of the human race's future in the 21st century. In the 20th century, we went to the moon, we went to the poles, we climbed Everest. In the 21st century, what's going to be the really visionary thing that's going to expand people's outlook on life and the universe and everything?
And Pascal, I mean, I am intrigued by your jacket there. I'd like you to talk us through some of the badges, not just the NASA and US flag ones, but over on the other side, you've got one with a Humvee trekking through the desert on what looks like four tractor tyres. Tell us a bit about that.
I'm just wearing my resume. So I work with the Mars Institute. It's a private research organization. It's international. And in fact, we would like to start a branch of the Mars Institute here in Australia in the years to come. The Mars Institute, of course, looks at how we will explore Mars in the future and sort of really approach this with a scientific and technical bent. So I'm actually based in California at the NASA Ames Research Center. NASA Ames is among the NASA centers known for the fact that it focuses on advancing science. Houston, for example, is focused on mission operations, astronaut training. The Kennedy Space Center launches rockets. Marshall builds rockets. NASA Ames does science, and so that's why I'm based there.
And you get in giant trucks with Caterpillar wheels on them.
That's right, and so as part of advancing science and trying to think about how humans will be exploring the moon and Mars in the future, we've been engaged in several campaigns now of essentially long drives across deserts. I just came back from 2 weeks of driving the Northwest Passage. We drove 500 kilometers on sea ice in a modified Humvee. And the patch that I'm wearing here is a patch of the expedition.
Yeah, you should write for Wheels as well as NASA. Yeah.
Malcolm, your contribution to going to Mars, you've just come back from the Pilbara. Can you join the dots for me? What were you doing up there?
I was out in the Pilbara with a Spanish documentary film crew, and they were making a one-hour documentary about the origin of life on Earth. And everybody who's interested in that subject wants to go to the Pilbara, and they want to go to Shark Bay. They want to go to the Pilbara because we have the oldest convincing evidence of life on Earth there, 3.5 billion years old. And they want to go to Shark Bay because it's the best place to see what the Earth used to look like when it was dominated by microbes.
Well, you're there at the University of New South Wales School of Astrobiology. Your sample size must be pretty small. What do you actually look at? I mean,
we look at all sorts of evidence from early life on Earth, and that comes in many forms, including quite gigantic forms, which are reefs that were actually built by microbes. These things are called stromatolites, and they're quite abundant on the ancient Earth, and that's what we also look at in Shark Bay. So we look at those. We look at the fossilised cells themselves, which you find in particular circumstances. We look at the chemical evidence for life on Earth, which comes in various forms, including carbon isotopes and sulphur isotopes. And we look for chemical compounds, particular forms of hydrocarbons that are degraded remnants of cells. And so we can find lots of varied evidence for early life on Earth. And we use that, connection to Mars, and we use that to explore the sorts of techniques that can be used on another planet, such as Mars, to look for life.
So by the time you guys have finished your work, we'll know how to get around on Mars without getting bogged, and we'll know what sort of bits of sampling we should be doing to look for life appropriately.
Yeah, where to go. I mean, just imagine the problem with Mars. The question, you've got a whole planet, and how do you find microbes on a planet?
Take a swab.
Too far, I can't reach.
We're getting ahead of ourselves, really, aren't we? Because we've already got to Mars. We've got various probes and explorers up there doing jobs and actually overachieving. John, give us a quick rundown of what's on Mars already.
At the moment, there are two rovers on the surface, Spirit and Opportunity. These are designed to last for 3 months, and they've lasted, 5 years? They're designed to go less than a kilometre. This was the mission specifications, and they've gone, one I think has just done 16 kilometres and the other one's sort of hovering around 7 or 8. So they're well and truly past the use-by date, and they're starting to get a bit long in the tooth and shaky like my old Magna out the front. But they have greatly improved our understanding of Mars. We've also got 3 satellites in orbit around Mars, the European Mars Express, been there for 5 years. There's a Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter from the US, and also another older satellite, the Mars Odyssey 2001, which has been there the past 8 years. So there's quite a lot of activity going on in Mars orbit and on the surface at the moment.
What sort of data are these rovers and orbiters? What are they collecting? What are they telling us about Mars?
Well, each one collects a different type of information, so they're very complementary. So, for example, the two small rovers, which are about the size of a bit bigger than a shopping trolley and a bit smaller than a golf cart, they've got a high-resolution stereoscopic colour digital camera, plus a number of backup cameras that help with navigation. It's got an infrared spectrometer. It has an arm that comes out that has a brush and an abrasive tool on it that allows you to chew away at the weathering rind on the top of the rock so you can see what it's like underneath. It's got a microscopic camera that looks at that surface. There's a Mossbauer spectrometer, which does also weird stuff, which I don't understand. I don't think anybody understands Mossbauer, do they?
You're in good hands this afternoon, aren't you, ladies and gentlemen?
So, in one sense, there's a lot of instruments. On the other hand, it's very, very limited. And you'd say that it's sort of toolkit that perhaps one person might carry around with them in the field.
So if it is just a toolkit that one person might carry around with them, and if we are making advances in robotics, as is happening in laboratories and universities around the world, do we really need to go to the expense and trouble of sending an actual human being to Mars, or can we just get some robots up there, get them doing the hard yakka and reporting back to us?
Well, we're doing that already, and it's part of the reconnaissance. But robots, when people use the word robot, we have this sort of idea of something out of Isaac Asimov, something with an infinite amount of power, infinite sagacity and wisdom, incredibly agile, incredibly dexterous.
That's what the press releases say.
That's right. But the point is that they're written by people who believe their own sales talk. The reality of these rovers, and marvellous machines though they are, is they can cover 6 metres a day. You know, they can walk from here to that railing up the back.
Well, have you ever got around in a 300-pound astronaut suit? I mean, maybe you couldn't go much further.
Well, the thing is, a 300-pound astronaut suit would weigh a lot less on Mars. And in fact, this is the goal with suit designs. People like Pascal and others have been involved, is to get it down to a weight that's reasonable. 20 kilograms on Mars is reasonable. I mean, think, you know, you look at infantrymen. You know, they carry 70, 80 kilos on their back. And so, yeah, these sort of loads, properly distributed, properly fitted out, are actually feasible for people to walk around in. And the thing is, you're not only going to be just walking around in. You know, 6 metres a day is what a rover can do, a robot can do. A human could walk on the moon during the Apollo program. They walked over 2 kilometres in a single EVA on Apollo 14. If you put them in a little thing like a golf buggy, a little rover, unpressurised rover, you could cover anything from 10 to 50, or maybe I'm in a really good going, 100 kilometres in a day.
Pascal, I'm a sceptical, you know, government treasurer, and I want to put money towards education and health, as we always do, instead of sending it to Mars. Sell me on that. Why should we send a person, why should we send astronauts to Mars?
What's the stimulus package? Yeah.
So, first of all, robots and humans are apples and oranges. Very purpose, the very reason why we even have a human space exploration program to begin with, regardless of where humans are going, is because it satisfies national interest. It satisfies the national interest of the nations who are undertaking space flight, who showcase their technology, their know-how in doing so. This is really something that has to be hammered in or realized, okay? James Cook was not sent to the South Pacific because somehow the British Navy was interested in the botany of the South Pacific. It was because the French were roaming those waters, and so were others. Similarly, Kennedy did not send Americans to the moon in the late 60s just because all of a sudden in the mid-60s we were interested in the origin of the Earth-Moon system. Americans were sent to the moon because there was a serious threat from the Soviet Union. They were first to launch a satellite, the first to launch a dog, any living being for that matter. They were about to send a human being. In fact, they had sent Gagarin into space. They were about to have a rendezvous in space. The first spacewalk was coming along as well. They were really ahead of the United States at the time. And Kennedy essentially asked, you know, what can we do that will be difficult enough for and far enough into the future that we have a chance to catch up and beat the Soviets at? And the answer, Mr. President, is getting a human being to the moon. And of course, that notion was very appealing. It was exciting. There was this whole, you could sell it to the public because it had this dimension of exploration, which was appealing. But the very purpose of doing that was to serve national interest.
But the Cold War is over, Pascal. What's going to be the driver to bother sending people to Mars?
That's right. So I think in wartime, you do need these kinds of challenges and these kinds of competitions to make exploration happen. But we are actually, I think, entering a new age on this planet. First of all, we are globalized. We're past the days of really competing superpower against superpower, okay, in ways that are not more productive than they have been in the past. A human mission to Mars is going to be the greatest exploration adventure of the 21st century. We still have lots to learn about the oceans. We need to fix climate change and focus on that as well. But in terms of advancing the frontiers of knowledge and exploring the unknown physically with humans out there, a mission to Mars really answers the call. The choice that we really face is this. Are we just going to have a space program with humans in space doing something that we're not interested in? It's just going to be a drag, but it's necessary because it serves national interest. Well, we're going to do something that will rally a number of international partners, will be a fantastic driver for education, the gain of knowledge. During the Apollo program, there was a surge in the number of graduate students who undertook studies in the sciences and math and physics. And that is what an inspiring science and technology program can do for you. And a human mission to Mars, I think, has that dimension to it.
So, Pascal, you've actually got two new presidents. You've got Obama as the national president, but you've also got a new president of NASA.
Yep.
How do they feel about the idea of going to Mars?
We don't know yet. In fact, NASA... President Obama has not done anything about the space program during the first 100 days officially. However, what is not well known, well, what is less known, is that immediately there was a group of advisors that were inserted into NASA, especially NASA headquarters, from day one, to understand better what was happening at NASA, where we were going, what could be done to do things better, and what the recommendations would be.
So you're still waiting on that score report?
So we're waiting on that score report, but in the meantime, a NASA administrator has been identified, and everybody suspects that Obama has some ideas about where the nation should be going, you know, exploration-wise and space-wise, but at the same time, there's a committee that was just convened, and you always do this. When in doubt, convene a committee. Okay. A committee was just convened. It's headed by Norm Augustine, who actually did the Challenger accident analysis back when the Challenger accident happened in 86. And the Augustine Commission, which includes astronaut Sally Ride and a few other people that are in the space business, is going to really review thoroughly where NASA's headed right now. And by the way, the space program is not just about NASA. I mean, I tend to talk about NASA, but from my perspective at least, I see really something like a human mission to Mars as being an international endeavor. It's something that will engage all of us here in Australia. It would be fantastic.
Malcolm, the nationalistic machismo aside, one reason to go to Mars is to look for life. Now, if there's anyone on the planet who can give me a straight answer as to what really are the chances of finding life and what would it be like, I'm hoping it's you. Not that your life on Mars, but you'll be able to give me a straight answer to that question. What are the chances of finding life in your estimations?
I think the chances are very high. As best I can understand what happened on the Earth, there was a series of chemical processes that led to the origin of life and all subsequent evolution. We know, or we've learnt from the last 50 years of the exploration of Mars, that early on in its history, the environment of Mars was similar in many ways to the environment on the Earth. And we learned from going to the Pilbara that at the same time, there was abundant microbial life. So just from one view of probabilities, and this can be disputed by people who play with probabilities, but from one view, I think we can say that life did start here by a set of chemical processes, and therefore there is no reason why it should not have also started on Mars. That's one answer to the question. The other answer is this, and that is that we've learnt that there is a traffic of meteorites between the planets. Now, this is quite a startling thing. We know that on Earth there are 30 or more meteorites that have come from Mars, and we know it with a fair degree of confidence at the moment. And what happens is if a large asteroid hits Mars with enough energy to blast off rocks at greater than what's called the escape velocity to get away from the gravity of the planet, and those rocks are blasted out into the solar system, and some of them eventually end up on other planets, such as here. And it would have happened the opposite way. There will be Earth meteorites on Mars. Now, why is that relevant to the question of life on Mars? Well, biologists have learned over the last 20 or 30 years that there's a whole ecosystem underground on Earth. So those rocks that are blasted off, in some cases, will contain samples of that underground microbial ecosystem. And it's almost inevitable that some of them will end up on Mars.
Professor Malcolm Walter, director of the Australian Centre for Astrobiology at the University of New South Wales. You're listening to Big Ideas and an Australian Science Festival event recorded last year in Canberra. We're dreaming about taking the trip to Mars. Is it worth it? Also on the panel are Dr. Jonathan Clark, Vice President of the Mars Society Australia, and planetary scientist Dr. Pascal Lee, Chairman of the Mars Institute, and he's also with the SETI Institute and the NASA Ames Research Centre. Our hosts are ABC's Paul Willis and Bernie Hobbs.
So, okay, so we've decided we are going to go there. John, how long's the trip going to take? Do I need 3 good books, 4, 20?
Well, how fast can you read? Or if you're an outback Australian driver, how many stubbies?
How many stubbies?
A typical mission length that people have been talking about is 6 months there, 18 months on the surface and 6 months back. You know, there are other ways of doing it. There's perhaps up to half a dozen different trajectories you can use to get to and from Mars. But what you want to do is go there in a shorter time as is economically feasible and also maximise the length of time on the planet. Like, you could get there in 4 months if you use some incredibly fast propulsion system and get back in a year, but then you only have a few weeks or to a month or two on the surface, which really is a waste of time.
What's the thing regulating the timetable?
Well, you've got the movement of the Earth around the Sun and the movement of Mars around the Sun further out. And the Earth is moving around every 12 months. Mars takes not quite 2 years. And every 26 months or thereabouts, they are close enough to be able to launch a spacecraft from Earth to Mars or the other way around with a minimum of propellant. If you launch outside that, you start running into really astronomical amounts of power and fuel needed to do it. It just becomes not worthwhile.
Pascal, but would it be a nice trip? What would you see out the window?
During the transfer to Mars, you would not see much. But as you approach Mars, within a few weeks of arriving at Mars, I think that you would have a glorious view of the planet. I mean, you'd have a growing orange ball there suspended in space. And I actually suspect that the early missions to Mars will actually not go to Mars itself. Just like during the Apollo program, we made sure that we could get there and come back first and then dealt with landing and the work on the surface afterwards. So the early missions to Mars are likely to just get into orbit around Mars and possibly explore Mars's moons. Mars has two fantastic little moons. They're this potato-shaped. The longest one is called Phobos. It's 22 kilometers long. The smaller one is called Deimos. It's farther out. It's 8 kilometers in length. And they are extremely interesting because they are likely to be captured asteroids, but then we're not quite sure since when and how they were even captured. From any one of those moons, you would also enjoy a fantastic view of the red planet, and there would be, I think, much excitement for a crew to even go to Mars without touching Mars.
No way! I'd feel so ripped off if I only got to go to one of the moons and then come home. Yeah, no, I nearly went to Mars. Yeah.
But if we're going to get there, modern rocketry is up to it. Actually, what I'll do here is I'll throw down the front here, we've got Michael West from the ANU, who's working on a plasma thruster, and he's about to tell me what a plasma thruster is.
Thanks, Paul. So we work at the ANU on what's called the Helicon double layer thruster, and it's a plasma thruster. What's a plasma? It's a superheated gas. So you'll know how chemical rockets work. You basically burn something. It's a controlled explosion, and that gives you thrust. Plasma works in a similar way, where we create a superheated gas, and then we expel ions, charged particles, to produce thrust. Now, the difference between a chemical rocket and a plasma rocket is that you produce a lot less thrust, but you use your propellant significantly more efficiently. So you get much more bang for your buck. Now, when it costs $10,000 to put something into low Earth orbit to get your fuel up there, every cent you can save in terms of the mass of your propellant is really, really important. I'll give you an example. The Apollo spacecraft went from low Earth orbit to the moon, used about 60 metric tons of propellant. To do the same thing, slightly smaller spacecraft using an electric propulsion system or a plasma rocket, the Smart One, used 58 kilograms of xenon. That's a lot of money. So the thing with exploring Mars is you could use this to significantly reduce how much you have to launch into orbit in order to get to Mars. Still takes about the same amount of time, but you can definitely reduce the cost and the payload.
And is you still having to get that fuel from Earth? It's not like you're using the solar wind or anything, not plasma from space.
Not the solar wind, but one of the interesting things about the particular plasma thruster that we're working on at the ANU is that you can use hydrogen or oxygen, and you can get them from water that you could either get off the International Space Station as a waste product, for example, or you can get it off the moons of Mars, which may have water. You can even use carbon dioxide, so there's possibilities there, but there's logistical issues and costs involved. But probably the first few missions, you take everything with you, but subsequent ones, you may want to use those resources you can find in situ.
First of all, ladies and gentlemen, Michael West. We are talking about an expensive endeavour, but I'm also trying to get a picture in my mind's eye of what it is we're talking about taking up there. And then let's work out from there as to what it's going to take to support that number of people on a ship. And then we'll figure out what the ship looks like. So how many people are we going to send up?
It's a good question. There are many ways to go to Mars. There's not a single way. But typically, people are power, and you do want to try to get as large a crew as you can, because if you can support the crew, well, then you're better off with more people. That's more resources, more think tank power, more ability to respond to a contingency, more redundancy. So the current scenarios are envisioning a crew of 8. And that may sound like a lot, but a space shuttle crew typically has 7 to 8 astronauts on board, so it's not that large a crew, considering the duration of the voyage. The other thing to realize is that with just 8 people, you're going to need a considerable amount of cross-training in their areas of expertise. You can't conceivably have just one pilot, one person who knows how to operate the, you know, the spacecraft systems on this 2.5-year journey to Mars. What if that something happened to that person? You really should be prepared to lose that person, possibly. And so you're going to need the crew members to have cross-training to really be well-prepared for a journey like this.
Are we talking a mix of genders, mix of nationalities?
Well, the issue of mix of gender, mix of nationality, marital mix, whether you should have married couples or just couples and not married, whether
I
you
can
should
see the
have,
church is coming, getting involved here.
You should have...
Thou shalt not orbit in sin!
Whether or not you should have an ethnic mix, etc., all of these are, in the end, political constraints. They have nothing to do with the reality of the performance of a crew. With a crew size as small as 8, the key thing that's really critical are the specific individuals involved in that crew. Because we're talking about small numbers. Now, what is going to be very important is that they be Renaissance people. They'll have to have the ability to really not just be jacks of many trades, okay, but be aces of many trades. As well, because of this requirement that they be so good and so well trained, they will have to be relatively seasoned astronauts. during the Apollo program, the average age of astronauts who walked on the moon was in their mid-30s. I think 32 was the average age, okay? This is not going to be the case for a mission to Mars. You're likely to have an average age of astronauts going to Mars that's going to be close to the late 40s or early 50s even.
Great midlife crisis.
Yeah. Talk about run away from the kids.
And a slightly greater age actually helps you on another front, which is space radiation. As soon as you pass your early 40s, your cell division rate is much slowed down, and you're less susceptible to developing skin cancers as a result of space radiation, as less than a person who's quite a bit younger.
So we're talking about sending 8 people up. I mean, that's a lot of Vegemite and toilet paper and all the other things that it takes to support 8 people for 18 months. We're talking about a very large ship, aren't we?
Well, there is a fairly well-established ratio. You need about a kilogram of dry food per person per day. And depending on how often you wash and other things, but your body needs about 2 liters of water and you need about 1 kilogram of oxygen. So for a 1,000-day mission, that's a ton of food, a ton of oxygen, and 2 tons of water per person. So that's 32 tons all up.
You just impressed me beyond belief.
But even 32 tons to take anything into orbit on Earth, weight for weight, costs more than gold.
Yeah, so you probably split it over several missions. Because remember, we're talking to Mars, we're not talking about a single one-year spectacular. You're talking about a 10-year program. You know, you'd probably send cargo perhaps a couple of years in advance. People would go to Mars. And you're talking about a program. Hopefully, it's not just going to be a one-off spectacular. It's actually going to be a program like going to the Antarctic where people go year after year. And so the costs can be spread out and you can get economies of scale.
Are there savings to be made through recycling? So you recycle your water, you recycle your food, you have a veggie patch on board?
Well, certainly one of the easiest things to recycle is water. Water, for example, the International Space Station is now being 90% of it is being recycled. And you know, people think, oh, you know, drinking your own urine, but in fact, which is what they're doing. But it's purified, and we do it all the time. It's called rain.
Worse, we drink other people's.
That's right. Isn't that great? Anyway, a lot of the moisture, water we drink, we actually exhale because our lung surfaces are moist, and so we breathe that out into the atmosphere. And so on the space station, they condense the water out of the atmosphere. And we see that with air conditioners. You know, there's always a puddle of water under the air conditioner because the water that that's in the atmosphere gets condensed out. That's one way of recycling. You collect that and you purify it and you reuse it. And that's comparatively easy. So we can get 80-90% of the 2 tons of water back. So instead of taking 2 tons of water per person for the mission, we might only have to take a few hundred kilograms, plus a margin in case there's a leak or something breaks down. Things like water, too, potentially we can extract on Mars. Again, maybe not on the first mission, but certainly on subsequent missions. One of the top priorities for an early mission is find a place and technology and test technology to extract water out of the ice, out of the water vapor in the atmosphere, perhaps cook it out of minerals, some of the sulfate minerals that are in the surface. And so there's lots of ways we can learn to minimize that logistic burden. Oxygen we can recycle, it takes a bit more power, but you can recycle perhaps half of the oxygen we breathe. Some of the water, our bodies actually are factories of water. We actually produce more water than we use by a small amount. And some of that is the oxygen that we breathe. So you can split the water back into oxygen and use that. And so perhaps half the oxygen, half of the ton of oxygen we use can be recycled. And again, perhaps on Mars we can extract oxygen from the carbon dioxide atmosphere by fairly simple chemistry and again reduce the amount we have to take. So we can take the 32 tons for 8 people and perhaps cut it down to 10 to 15 tons, which is still a fair bit. You wouldn't want to lift it, but it's a much more manageable mass.
Let's round it out to 20. Even so, shifting 20 tons from theoretically orbit around the Earth, so you're not lifting it off the surface in one go, getting it from orbit and Earth to Mars, you're talking about something that doesn't look like a rocket, aren't you? What does the ship actually look like?
Well, again, everybody's a spaceship designer. You know, if you laid all the plans for different spaceships to go to Mars or end-to-end, we'd be there. Right. And so there are an incredible number of configurations. One possibility might look a little bit like a space station, lots of modules, some for cargo, some for laboratories, and you break it. Others, it might look a little bit more like a space shuttle without wings, and it'd actually be able to use the atmosphere of Mars to break into orbit and save propellant that way. Because actually the biggest amount of stuff you've got to take to Mars is the propellant to come home, assuming you want to come home. There's a number of different configurations possible.
Cost?
Well, it's interesting. If you actually average the cost of the Apollo, put it into modern terms, and translate it into dollars per ton sent to the moon, comes up to about $330,000 a kilogram, International Space Station is about $200,000 a kilogram. So depending on how big your spaceship...
We're saving expensive. Money. We should do it.
Jonathan, you heading the Australian Mars Society would be well placed to give us some perspective. Is there room for a Vegemite muncher on board?
I think there's a lot of room for Vegemite munchers on board. And Australia has a lot to offer in many different ways. For starters, when we go to Mars and before we go to Mars, there are a lot of things in Australia that help us understand as what we call Mars analogues, in that they're features on Earth that help us understand what Mars was like, what it is like now, and are places where we can test out hardware. Malcolm's mentioned the Pilbara several times. We've got impact craters of various sizes and various degrees of erosion that we can study to help understand what Martian craters might be like. We've got a wide variety of terrains that we can test hardware, be they robot rovers or automatic drilling systems or spacesuits or handheld instruments or satellite instruments. We test them out in aircraft before we go there. And we can use these sort of environments, in Australian environments, which are... have a number of unique characteristics, just as US environments have their own US unique characteristics, and Devon Island is another area with its own unique characteristics. We can use these sort of environments to test our equipment, to test our ideas, so that when we go to Mars, we've got the best technology and the best knowledge base to do it. So that's one of the ways we can do it.
But what about cold hard cash, Jonathan? Are we actually contributing?
Well, in the last budget, Australia, for the first time in several decades, has actually got a budget item that is for space science. And this is a fantastic innovation. Australia, up to then, was almost the only OECD country without a space program. Belgium has a space program. Yeah, Denmark has instruments on Mars, on the Phoenix Mars lander. There were Danish and instruments from Switzerland on the Martian surface, but Australia didn't.
We can't be outdone by the Danes, surely. So how much are we coughing up? I mean, is it a sizable budget?
About $48 million, I think it is, per year.
Malcolm, is having a space program going to make a real difference? What's it going to give us that we haven't got now?
I think it is going to make a real difference, and I think it's really exciting. Finally, we have recognition of the importance of being involved in this international venture. And even though it is only $48 million, I think it's highly significant. It's symbolic. And the government is putting that money out there, I think, to see what might happen, what might come out of the woodwork. And if some good things come out of the woodwork in the next year, I think we can look forward to a continuing program in space science.
Do they want us, the European Space Agency? Or
the European Space Agency has made overtures to the Australian government in the past, as has NASA, to establish formal relationships that would be, well, sort of equivalent to having a space agency or something like that here, and every time they've been treated with politeness but have been rebuffed.
Wouldn't we want to be
hard
too
to get Malcolm.
Wouldn't want to be too heretical, but wouldn't we be better off teaming up with the Chinese? They're closer, they've got a big program, they're intending to go to Mars.
Why not?
Well, I mean, we're selling them the iron ore, for Pete's sake.
Well, my answer to that, Paul, is that we have a former diplomat as Prime Minister, and ask him about what's best to do.
He could give you an answer in Mandarin.
Yes, he could. That's quite complicated. Obviously, we should have a relationship with Asian space agencies, and a remarkable thing, it's like Jonathan said, of OECD countries. Most Asian nations have a space agency, and the Chinese are very keen to get to the moon, and the Japanese have substantial missions. And so, obviously, we shouldn't attempt to have some meaningful relationships with them. But the big players in the game right now are NASA and ESA. And they want us
to collaborate. Pascal, is it true? Do you want us at NASA?
Oh, yeah. I mean, NASA can use all the help it can get. First of all, I'm on a 10-day, 5-city tour of Australia. And I have really been impressed by the sheer world-class expertise that is available and existent in Australia. At the University of Adelaide, there's world-class expertise in hypersonics, for example. Very high-speed Mach 25 type of aerodynamics. There is expertise here at ANU on plasma engines, plasma rockets. There is expertise in the fact that Australians who are interested in Mars exploration understand the value of the outback and what it can do as a training ground. There's expertise in astrobiology with Malcolm and all the folks who team with him in Australia to advance the search for life and the understanding of life. These are key ingredients for Australia to be a real player and key contributor in a human mission to Mars, and not just the mission itself, but the steps towards that. And This notion that you might not have had funding in the past or in the recent past just baffles me, but I really am happy that some funding is now secured for advancing space science in Australia, and I'm sure that more will come and more should.
I really want to get a picture of what we would see when we landed on Mars. Is there anywhere we could go that really would give us a sense of what we're going to see physically when we get there? Just paint us a real picture of our first trip to Mars when you step off the rocket.
Well, imagine the most barren deserts on Earth, and there are two in that category, really. Well, there's three if you include the Sahara. The Atacama Desert in Chile, or the Namib Desert in southwest Africa. There's a little bit of vegetation in those places, but strip away even that little bit of vegetation and imagine a red desert. Remember, Mars is a red place because of iron oxides in the surface. And imagine a red sky. You wouldn't be able to breathe there because the atmospheric pressure is so low. It's only about, on average, 7 millibars, the equivalent of sea level compared to our 1,000 millibars. Almost no oxygen in the atmosphere. So if you're there in a spacesuit and it sprung a leak, you'd die very rapidly because of lack of oxygen. And you'd also depressurize, so your blood would boil and you'd burst.
What a place for pranksters.
You're really painting a picture of somewhere that produces simultaneously the world's most boring and the world's most sought-after postcards.
Yes, well, that's true. Also, it's a place with the largest volcano we know of in the solar system, Olympus Mons, which is 500 kilometres wide and 27 kilometres high, three times the height of Mount Everest. It has the greatest canyon known in the solar system, Valles Marineris, 2,500 kilometres or something like that.
Yeah, Perth to Auckland.
12 kilometres deep.
Perth to Auckland,
there you go. That's quite a chasm. It would really be a spectacularly beautiful landscape, but extremely hostile.
Professor Malcolm Walter, Director of the Australian Centre for Astrobiology at the University of New South Wales. You're with Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and an Australian Science Festival event forum recorded last year on the possibility of travelling to Mars. Is it worth the trip? Dr. Jonathan Clark, Vice President of the Mars Society Australia, and planetary scientist Dr. Pascal Lee are also on the panel, and our hosts are Paul Willis and Bernie Hobbs. Now, back to the audience for questions.
Would there be any advantage to launching a Mars attempt from the Moon?
That's a really good question. From an engineering standpoint, being on the Moon to launch to Mars doesn't buy you anything. In fact, it's more costly if you have to get to the Moon first, land on the Moon, because landing on the Moon takes fuel to slow yourself down against lunar gravity and soft land. And then if you have to extract yourself from the lunar gravitational well again, that really adds to the cost. So the nutshell answer is that from an engineering standpoint, it makes no sense to go to Mars somehow by landing on the Moon first. But the two reasons why we might still be going to the Moon first. One is that from a programmatic standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to really understand our backyard, to make full use of it, to learn how to explore Mars down the road. And so the Moon is a fantastic training ground and will serve that purpose in particular in the years to come as we go towards Mars to train astronauts, to conduct, for example, long-range exploration traverses with rovers, etc. So from that standpoint, yes, we should be going back to the Moon first and then going to Mars. But it's a programmatic argument, not an engineering one. The other situation where it might be good from an engineering standpoint is if we somehow had an infrastructure on the Moon. If we had a huge infrastructure on the Moon, almost like a society on the Moon, and we were extracting our resources from the Moon and have become somehow unreliant or non-reliant on the Earth at that point, well then, yes, launching from the Moon would be cheaper than from the Earth. But we're not there yet.
And from Laurie.
Can I ask the panel, assuming mankind does go to Mars and they find no form of life and microbes, and assuming there is water locked below the surface, would you be in favour of terraforming Mars?
I think we three might have three different answers to that. My answer is, why bother? And not only why bother, I would see it as an act of vandalism. My view is that we can learn a huge amount from Mars in terms of how planets form. We've lost the early history of our own planet because of tectonism. plate tectonics, continental drift. So we understand very little about the earlier stages of formation of the Earth, and indeed, for example, practical things like how ore deposits formed on the earliest Earth. That history is still present on Mars, and so from a geological point of view, we could learn a lot from studying Mars. Whether there is life or there is no life, as Johnson said, we can learn either way from Mars, but I see it as a place that could become like a giant, wouldn't be called a national park, but a place that should be conserved and studied, not exploited.
Pascal, is that what NASA's got on the plans?
Oh, NASA doesn't have any terraforming plans, but I recognise my personal thoughts and thinking on this subject with what Malcolm just said. For one thing, you know, the whole idea of terraforming is to transform this planet and do engineering on a planetary scale. Okay, and I think that, first of all, by the time we're actually able to do this in a way that is going to get to a point that we intended, we will be far advanced in a number of other technologies. Okay, we might actually, instead of changing the planet, engineer ourselves genetically differently to live on Mars almost as it is. That could be another option. We could be actually heading towards other stars. Just like we're not spending time terraforming Antarctica to make it more pleasant for us to live, we are unlikely, in my view, to transform Mars, really.
I think we actually are terraforming Antarctica at the moment.
Not intentionally, maybe. No.
Jonathan, would you want to terraform Mars?
It is a very interesting question. I think I have a number of takes on it. I think, as Pascal said, it's, you know, this is planetary scale engineering, and I think it would be, before we try tackling that on Mars, and we need to decide whether it's actually worthwhile, and we also need to make sure that we will do no harm, that it'll be an irreversible change, and we'd have to make sure that it's actually a change for the better in the big picture, rather than, oh crap, we've really stuffed it up this time. Yeah, that's right. And then, you know, rather than this sort of this visionary place in the sky, it becomes sort of a warning and something to be ashamed of every time we look at the night sky.
Well, it'd be a good heads up for anyone planning to visit Earth. All right, that's what they did on their first foray.
Well, that's right. I'd like to see ourselves making sure we manage our own environment better before we try and create a new one. On the other hand, you know, it would be a staged process. I mean, you know, first of all, we've got to get there. Secondly, we'd have to discover whether it's a place where people can live a long time. You know, people don't live permanently in the Antarctic. You know, people have lived there many years. Children have been born there, you know, gone to school there. But we haven't really settled Antarctica. So maybe Mars will never be more than an Antarctica in the sky. And that's still a very good thing because, you know, our exploration of Antarctica is enormously valuable. But maybe we will settle it, but there will be, you know, small settlements. We might have a dome over a crater. You know, it might be a few kilometres across, and we'll have these little oases living under glass. And we sort of have societies of thousands, millions of people. But beyond that, there will be this wonderful red wilderness where people will go for inspiration. The question you asked earlier was, what would be Mars like when we go there? And Malcolm talked about the Atacama. You know, I've spent months in the Atacama. I think it's one of the most magical places on Earth. You know, it's terrifying, it's awesome, it's beautiful, it's inspiring. And, you know, throughout history, artists and poets and mystics and philosophers have gone out into the desert seeking inspiration. And, you know, Mars is sort of the ultimate desert in some ways. So I think when we go to Mars, we will find it terrifying and beautiful and lethal and wonderful all at the same time.
Another question from the floor.
You're talking about a 30-month mission here, so 6 months either way, 80 months on the surface. Considering Mars doesn't have a magnetosphere or a decent atmosphere, how do you think the survivability side of the factor will be with radiation exposure for the crew?
Radiation exposure anywhere in space is a problem. Anywhere near the sun in the inner solar system is a problem. The source of the radiation is really twofold. There's galactic radiation, sort of the background that's always there and is bad news in general. And then there are the solar particle events, which are outbursts, basically, of radiation from the sun. And, of course, there's also the background from the sun as well. One of the most unpredictable and dangerous sources of radiation are these solar particle events, the SPE, solar particle events. And you will have essentially showers of protons coming at you from the sun, and you will be most vulnerable to these during your transit from the Earth to Mars and from Mars to the Earth. It's unclear whether or not being on Mars will be a good thing or not, because on the one hand, you are protected in some sense by the fact that there's some atmosphere above you and then the whole planet beneath you, and so that's some form of screening against general background radiation. But on the other hand, radiation coming from the sun, if it's energetic enough to reach the surface, which it could, could generate secondary radiation from the ground, and depending on what's in the ground. So it's unclear whether at this point being at the surface of Mars will really be, you know, a safe haven for you from the standpoint of radiation. But so therefore you're absolutely right. We have a big question mark still to answer with regards to the actual danger to us, space radiation. Now, there are ways to mitigate. One of the most potent ways of shielding yourself against radiation in space is hydrogen. Hydrogen tends to absorb the energy of incoming particles and scatter it, okay? Hydrogen, of course, is contained in water, and you will find hydrogen in carbohydrates as well, in your food. So one good way of shielding yourself against space radiation when you're transiting to Mars and coming back is to line the walls of your spacecraft with your water tanks and also with the food. Now, of course, as the mission progresses, Jonathan was explaining to you how, you'll recycle your water, fine, but you don't recycle your human waste, your feces, as well. In fact, you might re-extract the water out of your feces, but the feces themselves are not going to be recycled into food, but you cannot discard them either. You will have to carefully put them back into Ziploc bags, and the Ziplocs, properly locked, should go back on the wall. And
properly
you
locked.
You didn't tell us this facet about being on board earlier on. Sort of interior decorator have you been asking about?
It's certainly not the wallpaper they had in Barbarella.
I've been saying this on my talks. In my talks, you're going to go to Mars, okay, in a can of food, and then you're going to be coming back from Mars in a can of
toilet.
Okay, but there are other ways to protect yourself. You can also have a shelter deep in the core of your spacecraft where everybody would run to, a lead chamber, for example, and that's another radical way of shielding yourself against a radiation burst. But as you can imagine, lead is just dead weight otherwise, and it's something you can't take too much of.
I can see all the astronauts rehearsing their duck and cover, though, for the...
yeah, fantastic. Go to the Mars and you'll really be in the ship. Okay, another question from the floor.
Yeah, I'd ask the panel to comment on the problem of contamination in both directions, I suppose.
You mean contaminating Earth with Mars microbes and contaminating Mars with Earth microbes?
Absolutely.
Which way is worse?
Well, you don't want to contaminate what you are going to study. So you want to minimize forward contamination. And, of course, you don't want to contaminate the Earth with anything that might, you know, potentially be hostile to life on Earth. So this whole issue of planetary protection goes in two directions. And, in fact, there are entire conferences that are dedicated to addressing these issues and how to mitigate. It's an issue that has to be addressed even now as we send spacecraft to Mars. You know, should they be sterilized to the point where there's no chance of us bringing any form of life to the surface of Mars? And what level of sterilization is appropriate? The truth is, some spacecraft that have been headed to Mars in recent times were not fully sterilized. And the assumption there is that, well, if we did bring life from the Earth to Mars, it would not survive at the surface of Mars. What if the spacecraft crashes and digs a hole into the ground? What happens to that? And that actually happened. So the point is, there's the strategy, the general philosophy of how you want to do this, and then sort of what's practical in its application. But just to point out specific examples here, we actually conducted a study on this Northwest Passage Drive that was directly about that question. Okay, one of our studies was to measure, to collect samples of snow, upwind, downwind of the vehicle, up track, down track. And our vehicle is a pressurized rover simulator. So we were five people living inside this rover, and then at the end of each day, we open our doors, we set up camp. So the microbes that might have been living inside just fly outside the environment. Okay, and we collected these snow samples so that we would measure with high precision instruments any presence of human-associated microbes. The results are not published yet, but I can give it to you because we just got them yesterday. The human impact is essentially undetectable outside the vehicle. And meanwhile, there's a wild fauna of human-associated microbes inside the vehicle. In the surrounding terrain, the bugs simply do not survive and are barely scattered. That's one thing. And then the other thing is that over time, the variety, the diversity of human-associated microbes inside your vehicle decreases. And that's also understandable. At first, you know, in the first few days of traversing, you somehow a few bugs just hang on there. But without a constant resupply of healthy bugs, they are no longer able to survive in this harsh environment of the Arctic, and they die out, even inside the habitable environment of your vehicle. So to make a long story short, what that tells us is that even in a terrestrial context, forward contamination may be, you know, less of a risk than we might think, okay, although this is just one data point. And there are many more experiments like these that have to be done in the future to understand what risk we are incurring when we go explore Mars. But in some sense, you cannot explore the unknown without perturbing it. And you just have to take some precautions and do your best.
Can we just dwell for a moment on the concept of a human-associated fauna? What? I mean, you know, we wash. What exactly are we... I mean, we're not talking about pet cats and dogs here. We're talking about all kinds of nasty little bugs. Oh, or yeah. Some of them are nasty.
All kinds of human-associated microbes. There's a wide fauna of different types of bugs that we carry around us and also inside our bodies as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Michael is reminding me of this other issue, which is the backward contamination. What about life that could be coming from Mars? This is actually not an area of expertise of mine, but I can quote an important opinion on this. I was actually talking to Baruch Bloomberg, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the hepatitis B virus. The reason why I got to meet him is because he came up to Devon Island, to the site where we were working, and I asked him, you know, how plausible it is for us to find a form of life on Mars that somehow could be bad news for us. Because I had always understood that viruses need to be quite adapted to you before they could be bad news to you. I mean, they sort of have to, you have to sort of grow up with them before they can really harm you. His answer was, no, he could conceive of forms of life that could be microscopic and really bad news for us. And so this whole notion that you would want to quarantine the astronauts from coming back to the Earth, the notion that you would want to quarantine Mars samples, that you would return even with a robot to the Earth, is still an open subject. Okay.
Last question from the floor today.
I'm on Mars. I'm lost and my
radio... Uh-oh. Oh, I see.
I'm lost and my radio's broken. But I do have a clock and a magnetic compass, which is going to help me more, and why?
Does your Humvee have sat-nav?
Well, a magnetic compass would be useless because there's no magnetic field to speak of. And in fact, in the Arctic, we're used to that situation because even though there is a magnetic field, we happen to be very near the North Magnetic Pole. And so the needle tends to point down to the ground and tell you that you are there. Or pretty much. So the clock is definitely the tool that you would want, both in the Arctic or the Antarctic, for that matter. And
you'll know that you are here, and you'll know what time it is.
But you should bear in mind that the duration of a day on Mars is 24 hours and 37 minutes. And so, on the one hand, it's very close to the duration of our day, but on the other hand, it's got this extra 37 minutes each day that's going to throw everything off. So
now we'll finally have time to do all those self-improvement things we've been promising we would.
More sleep.
If only there was another hour in the day, go to Mars.
So you're going to have to keep track of that on your watch, basically.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a fascinating discussion this afternoon. It wouldn't have been possible without our three very talented guests. Please put your hands together for Dr. Jonathan Clark. Dr. Pascal Lee and Professor Malcolm Walter. Everyone's favourite alien, Bernie Hobbs.
And my favourite man on Earth, Paulie Willis.
Mars, Is It Worth the Trip? Was produced by Abby Thomas for the 2009 Australian Science Festival in Canberra. On the panel were Dr. Jonathan Clark, Vice President of the Mars Society Australia, Dr. Pascal Lee, Chairman of the Mars Institute and also Director of the Horton Mars Project at NASA Ames Research Centre, and Professor Malcolm Walter, Director of the Australian Centre for Astrobiology at the University of New South Wales. Thanks to sound engineer Michelle Goldsworthy. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and that was the final in our Summer of Science series for this year. I do hope you enjoyed it. For more information and downloadable audio of our Big Ideas Summer of Science, go to abc.net.au/rn/bigideas. And tune in next week to begin another stimulating year of Big Ideas listening. Thanks for your company.